She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And please don't ever forget, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thank you for joining us today. This show is sponsored by Chapman Tucson. I thank them for their support and for being the leader of sustainable practices among car dealerships in Southern Arizona. Thank you, Chapman. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 Radio and Castle Rock Radio Networks, where my shows can be heard weekly. Please visit my website page, mrsgreensworld.com/radio show, for weekly broadcast times and links to their website. A reminder to everybody that we interview guests from around the United States every Saturday at noon Arizona time at mrsgreensworld.com, and I certainly invite you to join us each week. We are also live streaming 24/7, and of course, we are iPhone and Android friendly. And if you can't listen live on Saturdays, all of the podcasts from the shows are posted on my website quite quickly, and I invite you always to connect with me on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. If you have questions, email info@mrsgreensworld about any of the shows or about any topic you'd like to hear about, because we are indeed creating a global community of people who care. So we are shaking the format up for the show a bit today, and I can do that because it's my show, and you know I like to shake things up. We are going commercial free and dedicating this entire hour to a topic that is truly of utmost importance to all of us. We will be talking about our oceans, just how endangered they are, and then, very importantly, what we can actually do about it. I'm going to interview two people, both of whom are doing very important work on all of our behalf. Our first guest is quite famous, and I'm sure you can hear me smiling through the airwaves, and it is my pleasure to welcome him as my guest for the first segment of the show. Welcome, Ted Danson. Yes, the very same Ted Danson, who has won numerous awards for his role as Sam Malone in the very long-running and much-loved TV series Cheers. A bit more about Ted in just a minute, and then it will be all about Ted. And for the second half of our show, I'm delighted to be interviewing Andy Sharpless, CEO of Oceana. Oceana was founded in 2001 and is the largest international organization focused solely on ocean conservation. And I don't want to rush through that. Solely on ocean conservation. So, Ted, you have certainly enjoyed many diverse roles in your successful career as an actor, up to and including your frequent appearance on Larry David's crazy mockumentary show, Curb Your Enthusiasm. So I thought about this a lot. Can I use this line? I can barely curb my enthusiasm because of your status as one of the world's most influential environmental activists for a cause that is among the most important to me personally as my role in Mrs. Green, heading off the total devastation of our oceans. And I want to add here, and I'll add it throughout the broadcast, that you are the author of the book Oceana, and it is what I call a very content-rich book, which educates one about our endangered oceans and, as I said, very importantly, provides solutions for what we can do about it, because sometimes it's daunting and it makes me sad, and I always like to have a call to action. So that's my very long, breathless, let's get on with the show and hear about what you're doing for this planet of ours and obviously your number one passion at this point in your life. And I'd love to start at the very beginning because I did read about the dream you had when you were seven and about the influence your parents had. I mean, that is a great dream. You were terrified. And then, as with many of us, that passion was ignited because of being a dad and what happened with you and your daughters walking on the beach. And I'd love you to share those stories to give people a feel for where it all started.
Sure. I mean, I start the book kind of tongue-in-cheek, because, and thank you, and it's nice to be here, and thank you for the introduction. Yeah, I used to have these fever dreams when I was about 7 or 8, and they had this kind of reoccurring theme of being overwhelmed by something. And when I'd wake up kind of screaming and going to my parents, and it became kind of, you know, old hat to them. They just kind of march me off into the bathroom and splash water in my face and go back to sleep. But when my mother said, what were you dreaming? I said, it's as if I'm on the beach and God's voice says, Ted, you have 1 hour to empty the ocean into this bucket, and hands me a spoon with holes in it. And, you know, it's your basic, you know, Messiah complex dream common to us actors. But I'd completely forgotten about it. I mean, it was just a fever dream. And then as I was writing the book, I kind of had hysterics thinking about, I actually did have that dream when I was 7 years old. Clearly, it was it has nothing to do with my activism, but I found it amusing. I guess I got started. Well, I should back up and tell you, my father, Ned Danson, was an archaeologist and anthropologist, and was a PhD that taught at the university in Tucson, and then became the assistant director of the Museum of Northern Arizona in the Research Center.
In Flagstaff, right.
In Flagstaff, right. And so I was surrounded by scientists, visiting scientists as a little boy, but I basically ran around playing with my Hopi and Navajo friends. But probably what kind of... you know, I absorbed peripherally, was that sense that there's a lot that has come before us and there's a lot that will come after us, hopefully, and that if this is not about you, your time here, it's about your stewardship of what you've been given so that you can pass it on to those who come behind you in as good, if not better, shape. So that probably was, you know, resting inside of me. And then I moved into a neighborhood, probably about the third or fourth year of Cheers. And it was in Santa Monica, California, right near the bay. And,
right.
A man named Robert Solnick was involved with stopping Occidental Petroleum from digging about 60 oil wells right along the beach there. And I, being a recent, recently moved into the neighborhood, joined forces. We became great friends, and we actually won that battle. And then naively thought we both cared about oceans. We both enjoyed each other's, company. Let's start an organization. I mean, it was that kind of, my father has a barn, let's put on a play. It was very naive. But we surrounded ourselves with scientists and lobbyists and learned more and more as we went. And we were encouraged, in our case, by the California congressional delegation, particularly Barbara Boxer, Leon Panetta back then,
wow.
George Miller, some wonderful
yeah.
people, because there wasn't a lot of energy about what was going on with our oceans. Then we did that for about 15 years, I guess. And then 10, 11, 12 years ago, Oceana was being formed by the Pew Foundation and other international foundations around the world to create a truly international organization dealing just with ocean issues. And we, at that time, merged, and I am now on the board of directors of that. That's kind of the how it all kind of started with me. I was lucky enough to have surrounded myself with an organization so I couldn't quit. You know, it'd be too embarrassing to kind of flip from one thing to another. So, I actually have learned a great deal, but I've always been the actor, the celebrity, the person who the press comes to. And And this is not me playing humble pie. I'm basically the guy in front of the tent that says, thank you so much for watching Cheers or whatever. I appreciate it, but I'm standing next to this marine biologist who has something really fascinating to tell you, and I think you should hear it. That's basically been, in broad strokes my job. I've been lucky enough to learn a lot in the process, but that still is my job.
Well, you know, total sidebar, quite a few of my friends went to see you when you came to Tucson for the Festival of Books, and the most retold story from them was, oh my God, here he is. You know, we went to see Sam Malone from Cheers, and you really did make it all about your nephew, Eric, who I am going to have on the show. I mean, you did.
And
they did.
Isn't
he great? Said he was very humble, and he was, you know, kind of self-effacing. So that's a really, it's really nice to know what people are telling Mrs. Green about you, because then you're going to hear it on the airwaves.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, there you go.
I pulled off this self-effacing act.
You
oh,
did.
Thank
it
God.
Worked. It worked. But I did catch that comment about, yeah, well, don't take pictures because, you know, I'll start posing. I mean, it's just, you've got, you really have great sense of humor. But the seriousness of this topic, it's so much fun to have fun on the show, and I love it. But there are days when I say, I'm just going to bed. I'm going to pull the covers up over it, and I'm going to wake up, and our oceans will have righted themselves. What I'd love you to do...
Well, you know, that's not a bad way to go, actually.
I mean, there for a long time.
No, you know, listen, I am very much hopeful. We know what to do. We know what's wrong. We know what's going on, and we know what to do about it. It's one of those environmental problems that can truly be fixed, not by sitting back and doing nothing, but by engaging the world and the world's fisheries. We really can do something about it. I mean, basically, Oceana's thought, premise, the reason why we're here, is that the biggest problem, right before Oceana was formed, there were these, and I'm blanking on the names of them, but the Pew Foundation did a study, a state of the oceans. So did actually, I think the federal government did a state of the oceans that was presented in Monterey. So what happened was Oceana took the top 10 or 15 problems facing the oceans, and we said, what can we make a difference? What can we do that, you know, can have the biggest impact on turning our oceans around? And we discovered the most pressing problem was overfishing, that we are taking too many fish out of the ocean and putting too much pollution in. And the combination is truly threatening the world's fisheries. And I say this right away so people don't get their, you know, their back riled. This country is pretty good at managing the world's fisheries.
I was actually going to ask you that. How's the United States, how's their report card?
We're pretty good. We don't over-subsidize, which is a huge problem, and we know how to manage our fisheries, and we've shut down bottom trawling. So let me just back up for a second and say, basically, you have these, you know, huge trawlers that trawl the size of the United States worldwide every year. And they have this gear now that is so powerful and heavy, and the engines of the ships are so big and powerful that they can drag a net on the bottom of the ocean with these heavy metal rollers that you could fit a 747, you know, inside that net. So instead of lifting the nets like they used to when they're afraid of them getting torn when they came to corals or rocks, they can now just plow right over anything and turn it into gravel. So basically they're destroying the habitat where the little fish grow into the big fish that we like to eat. So you want to stop that. But then those huge nets come up and they've caught everything,
all
literally.
All kinds of things in them.
They've
right.
dragged the bottom of the ocean. So whatever's there, they've got in their nets. But they're only after, you know, such and such fish. So the world throws overboard, dead or dying, from those nets, one-third of what it catches. So you're destroying the habitat, the nurseries, and you're being incredibly wasteful by throwing away about a third of what you catch. There are twice the amount of boats out in the water than you could sustainably manage because they are so heavily subsidized by governments. And the one thing that you know, Democrats and Republicans will unanimously back environmentally is getting rid of those worldwide subsidies, because we don't oversubsidize. So what happens is you get a government paying for about a quarter of your costs so that you can build bigger engines and pay for the gas to go off and do the things you shouldn't do for the health of the oceans. So that's something that Oceana has been fighting for years at the World Trade Organization and all over the world. So I'm kind of going fast and
rambling. But I just want to, it's a great point for me to interject. I interviewed Jennifer from the head of Seafood Watch at Monterey Bay Aquarium. And again, when you talk about hope, that organization is really being a catalyst for change because they have brought on a partner like Walmart, who I never really say a lot of praise for on the show for some of their other practices. But in terms of global leadership, they said to their suppliers, if you don't source sustainably, we're not going to buy our food from you. And I, from where I sit, the Seafood Watch popularity of people saying they're aware of it, asking restaurant owners, asking people I interview from all over the country. So when you talk, tying it back into hope, overfishing is a huge issue. But I do see hope in that area. Where
absolutely. The consumer is now, for several reasons. One, you know, if you are a lady of childbearing years, you, one out of six of you in this country has too much mercury in their system to safely give birth to a child without the risk of neurological damage. And that comes from the Bush administration's EPA.
It's a hardcore piece of science that has been,
hardcore piece of science. And it comes from certain kinds of fish that you eat, because the mercury from our coal-burning plants gets up in the air, falls down in the ocean, gets picked up through the gills of the little fish that the big fish eat. So you should not be eating, you know, tunas, sharks, swordfish, marlin, all the big fish that have been around long enough to absorb a lot of the mercury. So you need to educate yourself just from a public health point of view. Forget about saving fish, because that'll put people to sleep. Think about yourself and your kids. So you educate yourself. Then another piece of the puzzle is the amount of seafood fraud in this country is huge, around the world as well, but it's huge.
Huge.
70%, the FBI, I think this is the figure, 70% of what you eat is not what you think it is when you walk into a restaurant or shop at a market. And the problem with that is if you fished out such and such fish and you just stick that same name, Orange Ruffy.
Right.
All gone. So now we're going to fish this other rockfish and call it Orange Ruffy because you can get a good price for it. Well, that should make you angry, and you're not eating a fish that you know or is safe for you, mercury-wise or whatever. And the most important thing is you can't manage your fisheries because you don't know what's going on. So we have a big seafood
it's almost like a seafood
going on in Oceania.
Awareness.
Awareness.
What about, I want to know what you think now, because I read some about
it. Can you hold that one sec?
Yes.
I want to frame this because I know, having done this for long enough, if you talk about fish, you can put people to sleep in about 3 minutes. If you talk about fishermen, you've got them for about, saving fishermen and their jobs. You get about 10 minutes. But if you start talking about world hunger, then you get people's attention for much longer. And that's what we are truly talking about, is world hunger. Because one-sixth of the protein, animal protein, that this world consumes, roughly one-sixth, comes from the ocean, from fish. It's a clean protein. You do not use any water except, perhaps for processing to make that protein. You don't cut anything down to grow something, to feed it, to make that protein. It is about the purest, cleanest source of human protein that you can, we can have. Now, if you collapse the oceans, which we are at risk of doing, if we continue to harvest in such a wasteful way, then you are literally creating a worse problem for the world hunger situation. Sorry.
For the global population. No, I could not agree with you more. I mean, it's like it's all connected. And one of the challenges I face as Mrs. Green interviewing people in such a diverse, areas, and I have the oil people and the solar people and on and the alternative fuels people, is what you're talking about is the whole integration of thought. This is a food chain, and if we interrupt that, it's going to hurt all of us. And I agree with you. People do pay attention. If you talk to them about CO2 emissions and dead zones, you might hear the snoring on the line. But if you bring it down to, if I eat this, I might hurt my baby. Or if my daughter eats this, it might hurt my grandchild. They get their attention, and nobody really wakes up in the morning and
does it. Or if I go to a restaurant and pay X amount for, you know, Dover sole, and it's not Dover sole, I should be a little irritated.
Yeah, and it's New Jersey sole. And I'm a Jersey girl, so I know they do that.
Right. So, you know, 70% of the time you're getting cheated. So this is about educating yourself. And once you get educated, you know, you become interested, and then you can have an impact. As a consumer, you can say, whoa, you know, I want to know where this comes from. This fish. There's so much illegal fishing going on that if you ended up, and the problem with that is that you are decimating the world's fisheries. So pretty soon, no fish. Jellyfish soup will be on the menu.
Okay, so perfect segue. Where does Ted Danson weigh in on fish farms? Do you think there are ethical, organic, healthy ones? What's your spin on that?
Clearly that is where I think a lot of our, right now I think most, a huge amount, sorry, don't know the actual figures, but a huge amount of what the world consumes as fish come from fish farms. That is definitely something that needs to be explored. Now, saying that, it cannot be carnivorous fish. It cannot be salmon. All the salmon, you know, farms in Chile and all around the world have had huge problems because, you know, you are, to make a pound of wild salmon, it used to be that you would have to, you know, catch 3 pounds of wild fish, grind it up, and feed it to make that 1 pound of salmon. So you, up here in the Northern Hemisphere, you may be sitting down having a nice piece of farmed salmon, but down in the villages where, you know, they have those farms, they can't get a decent-sized fish anymore because they've all been caught, ground up to make your 1 pound of salmon. So it makes no sense, plus the amount of antibiotics that go into those farms because they're so jam-packed with fish that if you got a virus, your whole stock would be wiped out. You're absorbing so much you know, unwanted antibiotics into your body that farmed salmon is not a good way to go. Now, they are improving on it and working on it and all of that, but basically not a good way to go. Tuna, horrible. Tuna pens, horrible way to go. But now tilapia and other systems that are closed, that are vegetarian eating fishes, you know, that can work and does, and I'm sure there's a huge future in that.
And the thing that I see also, and I wonder if you agree with me, is that this is where the U.S. is getting a good grade. It's good on the report card because I see more development of organic fisheries. So they're trying to lead the way. And there's such transparency here. I mean, if you're screwing up and you have a filthy fish farm, somebody's going to stick in their YouTube video on YouTube and say, oh, yeah, you thought that was healthy fish. So it's not really happening. So the thing for me, the challenge for me now is that I've got you for 30 minutes, and I want to know, if do you have a top one, two, or three? Because there is overfishing. I am shocked when I hear more and more about ocean acidification, where entire populations are gone.
Yeah.
They're just gone forever, not gone for a little while.
Yep.
Wiped out, done.
Well, that's a huge, 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 you know, that's the 100-pound gorilla. You know, that is a tough subject. But it's, you know, it's one, at the same time, you're overfishing the top of the food chain, the big fish that we like to eat. You have things like ocean acidification, which comes from, and this is also not up for debate. You know, you can believe or not believe in, you know, climate change if you're an idiot. That's my opinion.
Totally agree.
But you cannot argue the facts about, because ocean acidification comes from man-made carbon dioxide getting pumped up into the ocean and then coming back down, filtering into the ocean, which has been doing this for, you know, centuries. I mean, forever. It absorbs the carbon dioxide, and it's reached the point now, because we have so much more pumping into the atmosphere, that it can't absorb it without, the ocean can't absorb it without changing the pH balance.
Right.
Just a little, but enough that it's turning the oceans acidic, which means at the bottom of the food chain, those little critters that use calcium to make their shells cannot form shells. It will not bind together. So you are, and coral reefs will start to dissolve. So you are starting to attack the bottom of the food chain the same time you're overfishing the top of the food chain. That's why there's a genuine concern that you could squeeze the life out of the oceans, which is why you have to, have very sensible guidelines for how much fish you take out of the ocean.
And the news on climate change has not been good of late, to say the least. I love Bill McGibbon, and he's lined up to be a guest, but he went from 350.org to now where we might be at 400. We are at 400.org. So it's the part, it's the pull the covers over the head thought I get, but then there's the Ted Dansons of the world and Mrs. Green doing her part. So ocean acidification, do you think we're making any progress in terms of offshore drilling globally?
Lord, that's a big one. Drill, baby, drill. That, that's just horrible. I will say, I will toot Oceana's horn. We just won a legal victory in Belize that has the second biggest coral reef system in the world after the Great Barrier Reef. And they were selling off, plots of coral reef to drill for oil. And it would have been devastating, just normal leaks would have been devastating. But if they'd had a spill, it would have been horrible. And, the coral reefs make up, once again, I'm making this up, but it's basically 1-3% of the footprint of the ocean floor is coral reefs. But they make something like 30% of the world's fish. So they're incredibly bountiful. They are the nurseries for the fish that we like to eat. So when you devastate them with oil spills, you just take, you're playing with fire. So, there are other ways to go than drilling in these areas where you cannot contain an oil spill that would devastate not only your tourism, but your fishing dollar,
And it's a big, huge, it's about, of course, earnings per share and profit. And the thing that frustrates me in my 5 years of doing this nonstop is that there are alternatives to fossil fuels. There are alternatives to drilling for oil. They're there. And it's one of those, what's it going to take for people to understand and to invest the resources in things accelerate it?
In this country, politically, the cynical thing is, look at the price at the gas pump, you have to drill. If we had drilled offshore oil and drilled for more oil, then we wouldn't be paying these huge prices at the gas pump. Well, that's just an out-and-out,
another big lie.
Misleading statement, because the price at the pump does not match the amount of oil that we drill in this country. It has nothing to do with that. Price at the pump is purely set by international circumstances. There's a hiccup in the Middle East, you will pay more. China does something, you will pay more. It has nothing to do with how much we pump or don't pump.
Exactly.
And if you sit there and you let BP or somebody drill off your coast in New Jersey, they are not going to go, thank you, New Jersey, for being so sweet, for taking all the risks of drilling in your oceans and ruining your tourist dollar and maybe your fisheries. We are going to give you this oil for a much less price. No, they sell it on the open market to the highest bidder. So it's very cynical to say we need to drill our coastlines so that we will benefit at the pump. It's just not true.
It is just not true. And this is where I still love the tagline of my show. We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to and do the research. So the very quick thing that we have to do, because it is we're right at 29 minutes. So, I've got about one more minute of Ted Danson. People on my show, people at part of Mrs. Green's world that are dedicated to creating a global community of people who care about issues like this, give us a call to action. I will Facebook, tweet it, write a blog about it, continue
to
do it.
Here's my call to action. Call to action, and it's a great segue. If you care about oceans, because everything else I don't really know what I'm talking about, go to oceana.org. It is a magnificent organization. And you need to become an ocean advocate at a worldwide level. Sadly, recycling and doing this and that is good, and good for your soul and good for the planet. But if you want to make a difference for the oceans, you have to do this on a global level. And it's very hard with your crazy day to do that. But you can go to oceana.org, go on our website, and click here, click there, and you will become an ocean advocate, which means that when they're called wave makers, which means when something comes up around the world that we need to send 100,000 emails to make a difference, you will be part of that if you choose to. And that makes a huge difference. So in 5 minutes
I will
a week,
put it
you
out
can
there.
Be an ocean advocate.
You can be an ocean advocate, and you're right. Recycling isn't going to get us there. People like Ted Danson are.
No. No, I talk a good fight. It'll be everybody else who does it.
And we'll be helping you with that. And I will tell you, thank you for what you do. Thanks for taking the time to be a part of Mrs. Green's World Interview.
Thank you.
And I hope our paths cross again sooner than later.
Too. And you're in for a treat with Andy Sharpless.
I can't wait. Okay,
yeah.
Thanks, Ted. It's
Bye.
Been a pleasure.
Yes, you too. Thanks.
And now for the second half of our special commercial-free show, please join me in welcoming Andy Sharpless, Chief Executive Officer for Oceana and author of the very recently released book, The Perfect Protein, a book about simultaneously working to save the oceans while also managing to produce a protein that can help to feed the world. Oceana was founded in 2001 and is the largest international organization focused solely on ocean conservation. Welcome, Andy, and thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, thank you. You're very kind.
It's like, is sleeping optional? That's what, when I read about people like you, I'm like, there's no way he sleeps. It can't be.
Well, I just got back from selling, encouraging people to read the book and selling the book in 5 cities in 5 days, so I am a little more toasted than normal today. It's true.
I'll believe it. Well, I will energize you. So when we spoke with Ted, he certainly made it abundantly clear as to why we should all care deeply about the conditions of our oceans. Even if we're landlocked, it's a globe that we're really talking about that's at risk here. So why don't we start with your realistic assessment of the shape our oceans are in and how intimately they are connected with the world's food supply, because that's where we'll get to the perfect protein.
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing, surprising thing. If you look at the share that wild fish currently play in our diet worldwide, they are equal in their share of the animal protein that human beings eat all over the world to eggs. So it's kind of like a big part of, it's a bigger part of, you know, how we all get by as people who, you know, many of whom are hungry than most people realize. And unfortunately, because we're not managing many parts of the ocean well, the world's catch has been going down for several decades. So at a moment when we have population booming and, you know, middle class is rising up and wanting to eat more meat, we've got the oceans able to provide less and less.
And the thing that's interesting to me is we tend to be so, I don't know if the right word is egocentric in the United States, oh, we're all fine because we can afford to pay for it. But when I went to Seafood Watch conference and you start thinking about the billions of people that can't just go down to Whole Foods and buy an organic egg, that's when your book, The Perfect Protein, for what we're going to face as a globe, as a global community, came front and center to me. So how did the work that you do with Oceana make you feel compelled to write the book? Did you hear the clock ticking like the alligator in Peter Pan? Was it like, tick, 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 I better tell people about this and come up with a solution?
Well, you know, I have asked myself kind of when I got the original inspiration for the book, and I think it's hard to know exactly where it came to me, but I think that it may have come in a meeting that I had in Geneva several years ago when I was meeting with the leading Chinese trade representative in Geneva. And the original purpose of my meeting with him was to, we had heard that they were considering building up their fleet, the Chinese fleet, so that it would be big as the Spanish fleet or the other big international fleets that fish all over the world. And, of course, that was concerning to us because that could lead to even more overfishing of the high seas. And he said basically, look, you know, don't lecture me. I got a billion people, many of whom are hungry, and we got to find a way to feed them, and we're going to do what we need to do to feed people. And, you know, it was a discouraging meeting from my for the purpose I had for it. But as I left, I had to admit that, you know, the moral task of feeding everybody on the planet is, you know, deserves a lot of respect, you know, and as does the moral task of protecting biodiversity, right? I mean, they're both really important things we need to do for the future. And the opportunity that's therefore started to really loom large to me was, well, wait a minute, in the ocean, we're eating a wild creature. And so the things that we do to protect the biodiversity of the ocean can make it a more abundant food resource. And so this war that we're used to, you know, seeing on the land, where, you know, biodiversity loss is driven by agriculture, is actually causing us to miss the opportunity the oceans present us, which is to do both things at once.
And you talk about it is the perfect marriage of, and it usually people would think that they're mutually exclusive, the perfect marriage of conservation and figuring out ways to feed the 9 billion people that we are projected to have on our planet. I think it grows something like 200,000 people every day. So talk a little bit about how that marriage of conservation fits in with feeding the people. I think that it certainly merits a little bit more discussion of what the concept is in the perfect protein.
Yeah, so two really important concepts, and then we can even unpack those further. But So, sometimes people have said to me, Andy, this is a really strange idea. You're talking about saving these creatures so that we can eat them. You know,
that's really the way the food chain works.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. But actually, and I understand why that reaction, people have that reaction. It's because the last wild animal that we all eat a lot of is wild ocean fish. I mean, most everything else that we eat is farmed. And so our relationship to the, you know, the wild creatures of the world is chiefly to think of them as creatures that, you know, deserve to exist and not to be eaten. But, you know, what we're talking about doing with the ocean is saving these creatures so that they can rebuild their populations and become more abundant in the ocean through doing the sorts of things that biodiversity-oriented organizations have always wanted done, and protecting, you know, setting scientific quotas and protecting habitat and reducing bycatch, and then having, you know, having more fish in the ocean that we can also eat more of. And, you know, that's like putting money into a bank account or putting money into the stock market so that you'll have more interest or more dividends in the future that you plan to spend. You know, we don't save money because we don't plan to spend it someday. So we're trying to bring that kind of same practical orientation to the ocean's wild fish stocks. Now, the other thing is really interesting that most people don't realize, and it's a big part of the perfect protein, is that when you think about the ocean, you worry that saving it or managing it well is necessarily a big international project, because the oceans look like they're international, right? I mean,
right.
They look like they're shared property of all the people of the world, and therefore we're going to have some UN-sponsored conference. And people, you know, we know that unfortunately the United Nations doesn't usually do a very good job. Countries don't agree easily, and they squabble over enforcement, and nothing really happens definitively, effectively out of the UN. So here's the really good news. There are charismatic fish in the ocean that are like lions and tigers, and we get misled by those creatures about where most of the fish are. And so an example of a charismatic lion or tiger of the ocean is tuna, which is a big predator, or swordfish, which is a big predator. And like a lion or tiger, it roams far and wide looking for things to eat. And those guys capture our imagination, and they make us misunderstand how the ocean fisheries really work. Most ocean fish are lower down on the food chain, and like rabbits, they don't roam far and wide. And indeed, they live their lives in the coastal zones. And the coastal zones are managed country by country.
Right.
They don't require international agreements. So the United States, which is one of the biggest, you know, it's in the top five countries in the world by the number of fish that we catch from our oceans, The United States sets the rules for fishing off the United States coasts, and we don't have to discuss that with anybody else in the world. We set the rules, we set the quotas, we set the habitat protections, we set the bycatch. Period. End of story. And our Coast Guard enforces them. And so we can have an abundant ocean if we want to do that. And in fact, the United States, since 1995, when President Clinton, who wrote the foreword to the book, updated the strengthened our fishery laws, those oceans have been generally getting better. Our oceans have been. And the Chileans, where Oceania works, which are the seventh largest fishing country in the world by weight,
right,
manage their ocean. And they've just tightened their laws in January of this year under leadership of their president.
Which was huge. I mean, that was huge.
And then the Europeans, believe it or not, which as a group are huge. They manage all 27 countries under rules on fisheries that they set in Brussels in one discussion. And so that makes them kind of like a country from the point of view of fishery management.
Right.
And they are the third largest in the world by weight. And, the right way to think about this is by weight, because from the point of view of feeding people, right, a pound of sardines is the same as a pound of tuna, right?
Right.
I mean, and in fact, in some ways, sardines are even better for you because they're less likely to have toxins in them. And they are lots of omegas in them. And so from the point of view of weight, turns out just 9 countries plus the European Union together, if you add up the fish that they manage country by country, you get 2/3 of the world's fish by weight. So just 9 countries in the European Union, 10 decision makers, can, not in a cooperative way, but country by country,
right,
deliver all this protein, all this fish, all this good stuff, all this good food, to the future if they will do good fishery management.
And does it matter then? Is it significant? Does it matter a lot where China weighs in on this, where India weighs in on this? I mean, the places with some of the fastest growing populations, it's just encouraging to me. And I didn't get that sense from being at Seafood Watch. It's like we have to get some of the other countries that are really consuming a great amount of fish to come on board with some of these conservation efforts.
No, the answer is that we do not need the Chinese or the Indians or any particular country to be part of this. If they choose not to be part of this, here's what will happen. The Chinese cannot fish in the American or the Chilean or the European Ocean except under the rules that the Americans and the Chileans and Europeans will set. And we, all three of those, countries have coast guards, and, Chinese aren't going to sneak in and catch a lot of fish.
That's right. They've got to follow the rules.
Yeah, they got to follow the rules. So, so that means that no amount of aggressive overfishing by any country, and China would be an example, can ruin the American Ocean, or the Chilean Ocean, or the European Ocean, or any other well-managed ocean. Now, there are places in the world that don't have, coast guards, and I'm sure that the aggressive fleets in the world will continue to push it, in their fleets into those waters and, do things that they shouldn't be doing. But the good news is that we can certainly get well over half of the world's fish well managed. And, if you 25 countries, if you look at the top 25 countries, you actually get 90% of the world's fish by weight. So, you can lose some countries from that list and still get a majority of the world's fish into an abundant situation. It would be nice to have China be doing a good job in its own fisheries. It is actually in the top 10, and India is in the top 10. So the two examples you asked about are, they could do a lot, by just managing their own fisheries well. But if they don't want to, that doesn't mean the rest of us have to fail.
Okay, that's so significant. And I think, you glossed over this, but I think it's great to revisit it about when you're talking about poultry and pork and beef and other animal proteins and even plant-based diet, they all require massive amounts of water. In some cases, they produce more greenhouse gases, the animal proteins. Why is the ocean such a really valuable solution for all of us that want to live long and prosper and have food?
Yeah, so I'm going to speak later on this week at a conference of biodiversity funders and experts, and I am going to say to them that the single biggest lever they have to protect biodiversity on the planet is to make the oceans more abundant. And they can, and they should do that even if they don't care about biodiversity in the ocean and they're only interested in biodiversity on the land. And the reason for that is that, as we've said, the biggest driver of biodiversity loss on the land is expanding agriculture. And what's one of the most aggressive forms of agriculture? It's livestock production. So when you're feeding cattle, when you're feeding chickens, when you're feeding pigs, you're feeding them grain, soybeans, corn, other grain that is being planted in huge areas, that many of which were once forests and biodiverse areas of the planet. And they're being irrigated, many of them from aquifers that are depleting and that are running dry. And so we need to be slowing the expansion of livestock production, not increasing it. So what's the most effective way to do that? Well, every time you deliver, some healthy pound of wild fish to somebody, you're not placing any demand on the world's natural freshwater system. You're not placing any demand on a cornfield anywhere. You're not, generating the methane emissions that livestock produces, which are a driver of climate change. All that is like a pure win. And in addition to the fact, by the way, that in particular in comparison with red meat, most fish are better for you. Your doctor will see it. So it's like a way to reduce your heart disease and your cancer and your obesity, prospects, and even to make your brain tuned up better. And I mean, that's why I called it the perfect protein. I mean, it's like, it's impossible to find a downside out of making the ocean more abundant. It's a win on every single dimension that human beings are worried about right now.
And there are so many other things like drought and wildfires and the impact of pesticides, all of those things that would not have to be managed and focused on so much if this happens. I think I read somewhere in the research that your team sent that if we do this right and could restore the oceans to their natural state, make it a sustainable manner, it's something like, was it 700 million meals a day that could be provided? I mean, that sounds like a very forever sustainable number to me.
Yes, that's correct. That you remembered it correctly. We estimate that a well-managed world's ocean could feed a healthy seafood meal to 700 million people every single day and do that forever and ever and ever. In fact, that's more than the oceans have ever done, but we can do that by managing them better than we have in the past, by putting some more money into the bank account or into, and therefore having some more interest from that bank account. And it's a wonderful thing. If we can even get to a bigger number, if we would do something that that would be more difficult even than good fishery management, and that would be to stop feeding fish to animals. And we take about a third of all the wild fish catch by weight and in the world right now, and we feed it to pigs and we feed it to other fish, and in the process we convert 3 or 4 or 5 pounds of wild fish into 1 pound of pig or 1 pound of farmed salmon or something like that. So if we were ready to stop doing that, we could feed even a billion people.
And I don't know. I, of course, being Mrs. Green for the past 5 years, I think we'll get there. I think people will be turning to Andy Sharpless for some answers, because there will literally be more people starving. Let's talk about a really happy part of your book, the recipes, and you have a great little guide about, people are sound bites about eating wild, eat small, eat local. And the last one, I think, is eat shellfish. Can you talk about... You've got great recipes in the book, so it's not just a book on how to conserve the world's ocean. There are practical, usable things that people will thoroughly delight in. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, So we have 21 recipes in the back of the book, each by a different celebrity chef, each featuring a fish that is abundant and is many cases lower down on the food chain than than fish that, you know, we're often used to eating here in the United States and in the developed part of the world. So, you know, recipe for anchovies, a recipe for sardines, you know, even a recipe for squid, things like that. I haven't tried all these recipes, but I've tried a number of them, and they're really good, and they're not so hard to prepare, and they're fun, and so the book is one of the best received parts of the book, frankly, has been the recipes. People, I don't have to tell you, people love cooking and eating good, tasty seafood. So this is, you know, we're really serious about promoting that and trying to make that easier for people. The other thing is, these rules that you just summarized are also our effort to kind of have, you know, a simple set of rules. You know, so many of your listeners may be familiar with the seafood guides that people, you know, can use to help
If they listen to me, they should be, because I talk about it all the time and blog and Facebook and tweet from Seafood Watch.
Yes, and those are wonderful guides, and the only drawback on those is that some people are just too busy, you know, to have them. And
you can get it on your phone. There's an app for that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a great thing. I want to go on record clearly.
Right.
I love those, and they're a good thing to do. But we were offering these four simple rules. Is if you don't have a seafood guide with you, or you can't remember, you don't have time, those rules that you just summarized, eat wild, eat local, eat smaller species, eat all the farm shellfish you can possibly take. We also have one other one that I've been talking about, and that is, I'm sorry to say, you have to give up shrimp. There's really no way to eat shrimp and feel like you're doing something good for the planet. Both wild and farm shrimp are problematic, and I can explain why that is if you wish.
I think you should, and I also think you should explain what you mean when you say eat small species. I think people, you know, what do you explain that to our listeners?
Sure. So let me start with that. So when you eat a small species, you're eating lower down on the food chain, and so you're very, so an example of that would be a sardine or an anchovy, and a high on the food chain example would be tuna or swordfish. And when you eat lower down on the food chain, it's very intuitive what you're doing. You're eating a fish that reproduces more quickly than the fish at the top of the food chain. Fish at the top of the food chain can live 30, 40 years. Many of them don't get even sexually reproductive until they're 7 or 8 years old, whereas fish at the bottom get going on reproducing much more quickly, and so they are more resilient, more rapidly growing species. It's easier for the ocean to produce a lot of them quickly and to keep doing that than it is fish at the top of the food chain. And so when you do that, your kind of natural footprint on the ocean is smaller. And also there's more margin for error. So if somebody unfortunately makes a mistake in a particular sardine fishery and they get the quota wrong or they destroy some key habitat, that's a more resilient species. It's going to come back more easily than a fish like a tuna would. And so that's the, and as I mentioned, by the way, they're very likely to have very little toxin in them, because the toxin accumulation in fish is pretty much driven by the age of the fish. So the longer the fish swims around, the more it's more likely to bioaccumulate metals and other things that you don't want to have in your meal. So that's the reason for eating small species. And that's a lot of what the recipes in the book feature, because they're the more innovative side of the message. I had somebody ask me, like, you're promoting trash fish here, aren't you? I really don't like that phrase.
I don't think that's good either. No, you're not. I didn't hear that at all. But really have to tell us before we run out of time. I mean, everybody I know eats shrimp, and we live in Tucson, and I travel. I mean, shrimp is on every menu, and I'm very happy that you brought that up. I, of course, am allergic to it, so I'm not guilty. But tell us about why not eat shrimp, why we have to give up our shrimp.
Yeah, so this is really unfortunate news, because we all do love shrimp, and there's really no way to eat it and feel good about it. You should stop eating it. So farm shrimp, first of all, wild shrimp are caught by shrimpers who drag nets through the water, typically in the Gulf of Mexico. Shrimp are appropriately named, right? They're very small. So if you're going to catch them, you have to have a small mesh net, and that means you'll catch everything else in the ocean along with them. And the ratio in the U.S. shrimp fishery is about 3-to-1 of non-shrimp for every pound of shrimp that a shrimper dumps out on his deck and sorts out. And in that process of dumping and sorting, there's a lot of damage done to everything that isn't the shrimp, and a lot of that's cast back into the water dead and dying. So when you eat a pound of wild shrimp, you have to picture you're also eating 3 pounds of other stuff that you didn't really want to be eating. It could even include a turtle, for example. Now, the farm shrimp side of things is equally ugly. The farm shrimp that we get here mostly are farmed in shallow ponds, many of them in tropical countries in the world where regulations are weak. The shallow ponds are created in coastal zones, many of them that are used to be mangrove forests that are an important nursery area for wild fish. They're densely packed in there. They're overfed. The fecal matter piles up in the ponds. They get dosed with antibiotics and pesticides so they don't die and get sick. As a result, you know, after a while, the pond gets so contaminated that the shrimper just moves on, leaving behind, you know, pretty ugly and almost industrial-seeming landscape. I've seen this myself in Belize, where Oceana works and where there used to be a lot of shrimp farming. And it's just an ugly scene. And
it's disgusting. I mean, it's disgusting to even think about it. I mean, I've seen a lot of those videos on the farms, and, I mean, if anybody watched that, they would really not want to put a piece of shrimp in their mouth again, if you ask me.
No, I agree with you. It's not, I totally agree with you. When you really picture what's going on and you, and just from your own point of view of like whether you're eating something that's genuinely healthy, you could ask that question. But certainly if you think about what's being done in the country where it's farmed, now technically one could solve this problem. I mean, it's technically achievable to have a clean shrimp farm. It's just that that farm would have to sell its shrimp for 2 or 3 times what people are used to paying for it. And so that guy won't make any money, and so it's not being done.
So we know that's not going to happen because it's about earnings per share or the bottom line, the profit margin.
I mean, they have a business, they have a price point that people used to paying, so they can't, you know, they can't triple the price and expect the people to pay them.
Well, I don't want to run out of time because it has flown. We have about 4 minutes left. Let's get in the call to action because I think people are going to be very excited about getting the perfect protein. You have an official website. You have a Facebook page. I noticed, because I love Twitter, that the hashtag, you have your own hashtag for perfect protein. What's the easiest way for people to get the book and support the work that you're doing, which is, by the way, providing nutritious meals to billions of hungry people around the world? There's lots of really sweet spots in this whole call to action.
Yeah, so go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whoever your favorite bookseller is and buy the perfect protein. That's step number one, I would hope people will do. I'm getting a lot of positive feedback on the book, and we're real proud of it, and I think people will be happy to read it. That's number one. Number two, you can use your own decisions about what fish to eat and be guided by these rules that we've talked about. Eat wild, eat small, eat local, eat all the farm shellfish you can, and don't eat shrimp. And then number three, you can be an active citizen. So we can deliver an abundant American ocean to the future if the laws that are in place are vigorously enforced. And those laws, I mean, we're in a nice situation here. Those laws were tightened in 1995 in a bipartisan action by President Clinton and the Republican senator from Alaska, then Senator Stevens. And so those laws are good. They need to be enforced. Those require scientific quotas and protection of nursery habitat and reduction of bycatch. And so people will come to Oceana and join up. They can get on our email list. They can go to other organizations like Oceana and who are involved in oceans. And you'll be notified if, you know, there's a decision coming up or somebody needs to be pushed to make sure that they remember what the law is and that they don't take a short-sighted decision about, for example, a quota for a fishery or something. And that kind of action really does matter. And you know, it is actually working in the United States of America. I mean, we're seeing our fisheries come back.
It's really, really encouraging. And I did go sign up. As soon as I interviewed Ted, I went and I walked the walk and I signed up. And one of the things I have to mention is you're not inundating me with emails. I'm not getting 5 alerts a day. But when I get one, I open it and watch it. And I want to encourage people, don't think you have to pledge $10,000. If, you know, 100 people listening all pledged $100 for the year, that would help. So do whatever you can. Andy Sharpless, thank you so much. If you just tuned in, you're going to want to listen to this whole podcast. Andy Sharpless is the Chief Executive Officer for Oceana and author of the very recently released book, The Perfect Protein, and it certainly sounds like it is. Thank you so much, Andy, for being a part of Mrs. Green's world and taking time out of your really, really, really busy schedule for doing this interview. Next week, Jim Cook, Executive Director and CEO of the Western National Parks Association, and Eric Penner Howery, author of the book Steward of the New West, about Edward Bridge Danson, father of Ted and Jan Danson. Hope you'll plan to join us. And again, make it a great green week. Don't eat shrimp. That's my final shout out for this show. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.